And this is Jesus speaking to his Father. He says, I do not ask on behalf of those only, but on behalf of those, Father, who will believe in me because of their word, because of my disciples' message, that they may be one, Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they be also be in us, in order that the world may know that you sent me, or that you believe that you sent me. And the glory that you've given me, I have given to them, in order that they may be one, Father, just as we are one, I in them and you in me, in order that they may be completed or completely in one, so that the world may know that you sent me and you have loved them just as you have loved me. I don't know if any of you have ever been to summer camp before, but when I was in high school, I had the chance to go to summer camp 4 successive summers, saving up all my money and getting to go. The year is 1975, and this is the holy grail for me as a high school boy. Camp represents girls. Just being honest, there's sports and girls, and then there's Jesus and there's girls. And there's speakers, and it's in California. I was in Colorado. There's camping. There's beaches. And did I say girls? There are girls there, too. And this was my mindset. And at the beginning of the week, we would show up at the camp, and we would be assigned to a different cabin. And the cabin, we would go into that cabin, and you plop your bedroll down on the bunk and your duffel bag there as well. And then you meet a bunch of people that you have never seen before in your life. Bunch of strangers. And you start out that first day kind of sizing everybody up in terms of what they look like, or this guy looks a little goofy, or he's got a goofy hair, or he doesn't have enough hair. At that point in time, it was wearing hair about down to here. I know that's hard to believe, but yes, it's true. And day one goes by, and we're strangers. We have a lunch, and then we have a dinner together. And we sleep in the same place. You find out who sleeps well, who snores, et cetera, et cetera. We didn't have earplugs at that point in time, even though it would have been a lifesaver. We wake up, we have breakfast together, family style at a table. And now these acquaintances or these strangers have turned into acquaintances. And then they do a bunch of games, like Olympic-style games, throughout that day, and these acquaintances turn from acquaintances to teammates. And then by the end of day one, we're beginning to get along with each other a bit. Then at the beginning of day three, we start, you know, in this sort of teammates thing, and by the end of day three, we're actually fast friends. At the end of day four, we're actually brothers and sisters with the different people that are at the camp. The end of day five, we're family. And then it's time to go. And I want to say that as high as the ups were of being with these people that you have spent the time in the trenches and gotten close and connected and raw, it's been fun, there's laughter, there's tears, there's all kinds of different life that we shared, the tearing that you feel at the end of that camp is awful. But it's awful because there was connection that was made. Do you know what I'm saying? I think that most of us, at some point in time in our lives, have experienced connection and closeness with other people, that we've experienced a deep sharing of life where you've been accepted and loved, perhaps even cherished and valued in such a way that it was profound. It had a profound effect on you. That connection, that interconnectedness, that intimacy has made these people now somehow part of you. And so then to part ways with them, to disengage, it hurts like heck. I want to say to you this morning that you were built for this kind of connection. I'm just going to put it right out there. You were built for this kind of connection with people. After the image of God, you were built for it. And I think that we spend our lives searching all kinds of different places to be able to find that kind of connection. But for many of us, perhaps even most of us, it's been sort of a looking for love in all the wrong places kind of a dynamic. You know what I'm saying? But the reality is that every single one of us have this beacon, this homing beacon, that we want to be connected to people, and we've been built for it, and we've been built to be connected with God. Introverts, extroverts, same. Happy, sad, bold, quiet, daring, or fearful, it doesn't matter. Everybody wants it. Everybody needs it. We've been built for that by God. And because we're looking for this, when we experience it, it's fireworks. And when we don't experience it, we're in the hunt for it. Or perhaps that we've experienced it and then it's been torn away from us and we are so protected now because we don't want to feel the emptiness and the loneliness that it feels to be disconnected from those relationships. And so we'll build a wall around ourselves just to protect ourselves from that feeling of emptiness. And yet we don't really realize that the wall that we've built is actually creating the emptiness. Are you with me so far? And so we've been built for this. But here's what I want to investigate with you this morning. What if connection is actually part of how God designed you? That he actually designed you this way, and that what if you were built for that connection with both God and with others, and that in some imperfect way we've always been seeking it. I was seeking it with girls. That's the reason why girls figured so prominently in my story. But we seek it in romantic relationships. We seek that in marital relationships. But marriage, actually, if it's intended to be the end all of intimacy and connection, marriage will underdeliver about 100% of the time. Because God has not made you to have one person meet all of your needs. He never did. Now, the weight of this is spread across a lot of relationships. That's how you and I have been designed. We seek it in friendship. We seek it in gangs, in parties, in cliques. We seek it in churches and in clubs. We seek it in friends and we seek it in family. But we are all seekers of this. One songwriter that put it this way, every heart is a hunter, hunting for this kind of connection. Every heart is a hunter. And this hunger for connection is something that God put inside of you. And when it is redeemed and aimed in the right direction, it's powerful in its effect in terms of creating a satisfaction in life that all of us have longed for. And on the flip side of that, it's powerful in terms of its devastating effect because when it is torn from you or when it is hurt, it hurts badly. You know what I'm saying? And we've all experienced this. If you've had a pulse on planet Earth for more than about 2 weeks, you've experienced this, right? We've experienced this kind of hurt. And so this particular portion of Jesus' prayer in John 17 is the place where Jesus is actually bearing his heart with regard to this idea of oneness, of connection, of God-designed connection. Now remember that we are listening in on the conversation at the very center of the universe. This is God the Son talking with God the Father. This is God praying to God. And we are hearing the very heart of God. And if you want to put your head on Jesus' chest the way that the Apostle John, the writer of John's Gospel, if we want to put our heart, our ear on Jesus' chest to get our heart as close to his as we possibly can, this is what's on his heart. And he starts out by saying this, I do not ask, Father, on behalf of these alone, that's the 12, the disciples that he's got with him, but also on behalf of those who believe in me through their witness or their word. I'm praying for them. So Jesus says, I've revealed them myself to them, Father, and I'm looking for them now to reveal me to others. That's where all of this is going, that Jesus has become real to them. And now out of that, he is saying, now you go do the same. He says that he wants others to hear their message and hear about him, that they would put their trust in, that's what that word faith means, they put their trust in him, that they would connect to him and to his earthly family. Very simple. Hear, believe, connect. Say that with me. Hear, believe, connect. Hear, believe, connect. That's what this is about. Now think for a moment with me, if you will, because he's praying this for his 12 and then those who are ripple effect selected from the 12, who is it that God has put into your life right now, in the here and now, who God has put in your life for them to be a ripple effect in your life? Think. I think a lot of times we think, well, who can I go create opportunities with? No, God has already put you in places where he wants you to shine, where he wants you to have his effect there. He wants to reveal himself through you. Who? Who? Hear, believe, connect. And there's something that's interesting that's behind this, though, that I think is quite beautiful. It's another dimension that's behind this, and that is that Jesus sees that the work he's doing with his boys, with his guys, that is not just for them. The work that he's doing in them and is always intended to go through them out to others. That nothing, God wastes nothing, and that he is always working 2, 4, 50, 100, a billion steps ahead. He's weaving things. He's moving things together. He's moving people into the right places. And God is always doing that. Some of you know that I lost my dad several weeks ago, and I was in Phoenix basically wrapping up his final effects, making the final arrangements. And we went out to dinner with his friends. My brother and I went out to dinner with them. And I sat next to the girlfriend of one of his friends at the table. Nice restaurant, high dollar. My brother and I don't know what to expect. Well, it turns out the woman sitting on my left, who wasn't a friend of my dad's, she was just a girlfriend of one of them. It turned out that she had previously been married to a guy that they have actually been a part of a number of church plants, and they happen to be actually Vineyard church plants, and that's the movement that I came from. And so I realized as we talked, there was all these shared experiences that we had in the same place, but we never knew each other. And we got along great. We had a great conversation. And the stuff is, they're telling stories of our dad around the table. And then she and I are conversing here and there. And at one point in time, the guy said, yeah, there was a point in time where your dad's big deals of the day. My dad was a con man. So just saying. And the big deals of the day went from millions of dollars to hundreds of million dollars to billions of dollars. And just a deal that didn't yield billions of dollars just didn't. It just wasn't worth pursuing. And again, mind you, all of these are smoke and mirrors. None of them are real. And they are all talking about that sort of lightly laughing. And I turned to her and I said, you know what? I am the richest man at this table, and it isn't even a race. I am the richest man at this table in what really matters in relationships. I am the richest man. And after that time at dinner, I was praying, spending some time with the Lord. And I said to the Lord, and I don't know, you have this kind of conversation with the Lord, but I said, Lord, thanks for throwing me a bone by having Lisa sit next to me at dinner. Because I was uncomfortable. I didn't know what that dinner was going to be like. I didn't know what this was going to be. Thanks for throwing the bone. And the Lord said to me, just quip back very quickly, the bone was not for you, Bob. You mean it's not all about me? You know the answer to that question, correct? It's not. It's not all about you. We say this to our kids, but then we get to be adults and we just dress it up really differently. But it's all about us. No, it's not all about us. That God is, the Lord is always weaving into our lives, weaving us into the lives of others in order to have his effect on them. My guess would be that's how you even made it here today. Is because of some relationship with somebody at some period of time. God wastes nothing. He wastes nothing. Now let's pick it up. I want to read the whole passage to you one more time. Jesus says, I don't only pray for these alone, the 12, but also for those who will believe in me through their word or their message, that they may be one. Father, just as I am in you and you are in me, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you sent me. The glory that you have given me, I've given to them. in order that they may be one, just as we are one. And listen to this formula. I in them, you in me, in order that they may be completed into or completely one, so that the world may know that you sent me and that you have loved them just like you've loved me. Just like you've loved me. That they may be one. That's what Jesus is praying. And if we want to put our heart, our ear on Jesus' heart, we must ask that question, what does that look like? What are you even talking about, Jesus? And Jesus is talking about a relationship that he has with his Father. He's talking about what he and his Father share. He talks about this idea that just as you, Father, are in me and I am in you, and he's talking about a relationship that is so together that the only way to describe it is one or oneness. Oneness is what God, Father, Son, and Spirit share. I love the way, and I'll read this to you. I read it several weeks back, but it bears to repeat. This is what theologian Baxter Kruger said. He said, and Baxter's from Mississippi, and he's got this heavy Southern drawl, so I'm going to try to give you my Baxter Kruger imitation with this. This relationship is so unclouded communion and fellowship is so deep, so beautiful, so non-religious, so personal, and so open, that the only way we can begin to describe this relationship is that they are face-to-face, and so face-to-face that they actually dwell in one another in love. Anything less than the word love betrays their togetherness, and yet the Father never becomes the Son, and the Son never becomes the Father. And the Spirit is never lost between the Father and the Son. This relationship of three persons that is so beautiful that they are one, yet they do not lose themselves in the process. There's no way to describe it any better than that. Oneness is not a concept. Oneness is not an equation. It's not like 1 plus 1 plus 1 equal 1. The math simply doesn't work. That what's being described here is a relationship between Father, Son, and Spirit, God who is three and also one all at the same time. It is a connection that's being described, a oneness and an intimacy that is so profound that the only way to even describe it is to say that they mutually indwell each other. It's a similar kind of an idea that's being given when we talk about marriage and the two becoming one flesh. That there's a sharing and an intermingling of lives, so much so that the two lives are lost in the one. And yet somehow they become more themselves, not less, by experiencing the oneness. And this is the vision that Jesus is giving us. That Jesus prays that we would be enveloped in this oneness that he and his Father share. May they be in us, he prays. They be in us, Father. And he's then invited us and ushered us into a kind and quality of relationship that he and the Father already share. That is being given. No. That is enveloping us. It's not just being given to us. It is ours. My daughter, Becca, is a sophomore at Biola University. And, woohoo, go Biola. Yeah, there you go. And you don't know the story, but there were some alien abduction years with her as well, not just with my daughter, Hannah. And she became a female very difficult to get on with in my life. But not anymore. And we share this connection and this love that is so tender and so beautiful, and it's extraordinary, and it's a gift from God. Becca actually said several weeks ago, she said, Dad, when I describe you to people, I just say, it's just so hard to describe that you're my dad and you're one of my best friends all at the same time. You know, and I said, Dad, that's like, oh, baby. You know, that was the target. That was what we were seeking. She has a friend her BFF named Delaney. And Becca has told Delaney so much about me that when Delaney came, she came and just gave me this mammoth hug, and she just held on to me, and I just enveloped her in this hug. And since then, since day one with Delaney coming into our house, she even calls me Dad. And she comes from a family that's not a bad family at all, but just not a particularly close one, and she calls me Dad. Well, but Delaney comes in, and what she's done is that she's believed what Becca said about me. She's taken that inside of herself. Becca and her came home 2 weeks ago, and I was sitting on the couch, and Delaney just came, and she just perched herself kind of almost on me and under my arm on the couch. And just kind of snuggled up and nestled up, you know, against me and the whole thing. But what she is doing is she is enjoying a relationship that she got because of Becca's relationship with me. Does that make sense? If Becca didn't feel comfortable with me, Delaney would not feel comfortable with me. If Delaney came into our house by herself, she would just go, I think I'm going somewhere else. The bald guy is a little too intimidating, but nope. But Delaney comes in on the basis of my daughter's relationship with me. And then she's able to share in that relationship with me because she knows the guy that Becca trusts. Does that make sense? This is what Jesus is giving to you and to me. Except for that it's perfect. I'm imperfect on my very best day. But this is the kind of relationship that Jesus is imaging to us. Just like Del now shares in the relationship Becca shares with me, you share in Jesus' relationship with his Father, and that's the design. I like the way that Jim Smith, in his book series, Good and Beautiful God, the way that he says that in the tagline on the front page of the first book, falling in love with the God that Jesus knows. That is the key. This is the God that Jesus knows. This is what we've been invited and who we've been invited to connect with. This is the relationship now that we share. So if that's the case, then what are the pyrotechnics? What are the dynamics? Or even I would say the pathways to move within the rhythms of this. And I would say that there are fourfold from this passage. There is trust. There is sharing, there is holding nothing back, and there is, as a result of that, a connection. Let me pick these apart for just a moment with you. So if we're going to move in this kind of relationship, if we're going to move in any relationship where there actually is intimacy, there has to be trust. Would you agree with that? There has to be trust in order to have intimacy. Impossible to have intimacy without trust. But Jesus says, he prays several times within this passage that we're looking at this morning that people would believe. And when we use the word believe, it's the same word as trust. For us to say that we entrust ourselves or we trust him is to say that we have become confident in the character and the goodness of the one that we are trusting. We're confident in that character. And so therefore, God has, instead of being big and scary, now God is somehow safe. And as a result of that, walls come down. Oh, when you are intimate in a trusting relationship, your walls come down because you trust that what you're going to get from that person is going to be consistently good. Or else your walls would stay up. And so to be able to encounter and experience oneness with God, this oneness that is already mine, I'm going to have to actually trust. And if I'm going to experience this oneness one to another with people that are in my world and you with people that are in your world, you're going to have to trust. And some of us are frozen in that moment. Wait a minute. And if you can't get out of the starting blocks of trust, you can't move into oneness. No way around that. And so the Lord says, firstly, to move into this, to stop the wheels spinning and to settle down in a relationship where God is, he's safe to be around for you, you're going to have to trust. First question. If you had to, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being complete and total trust, and zero being absolutely no trust or all mistrust. On a scale of 1 to 10, where are you? You can't be 5. Let's take 5 off of it. Think, where are you? Because you can't be somewhere where you're not until you actually, where you want to be, until you are where you are. Where are you in your trust with God, and where are you in your trust with some of those significant others in your own life? Trust. Secondly, so trust is the fiber and the fabric of our intimacy with God and our oneness with Him and our oneness with others. But there's something that actually sets the stage for a life of true sharing and of giving. And that's the idea throughout the New Testament. Jesus says, Father, the glory that you've given me, I gave to them. Remember, Jesus, you know, John 3:16, God loved the world so much that He gave His one and only Son, that whoever believes in Him would not perish but have eternal life. Then Jesus prays earlier on in this prayer, Jesus said, the guys that you gave me, Lord, that these people have been guys that the Father has given to Jesus, and Jesus has been glorified in them. And then you see in this prayer, Jesus, it says, gave the glory that the Father gave to Him, He gave that to His disciples. So what are we talking about here? Because not a single one of you, if glory is radiance, not a single one of you are shining right now. Just saying. As I'm looking out there, I'm not seeing any of you like, you know, it's not happening. What's being said? We saw this a number of weeks ago, that glory is manifesting the luminous and weighty essence of something. And so when Jesus is glorifying the Father, He's manifesting the fullness of God's character and life in the midst of a very dark place. And Jesus says, that glory I manifested to them, and I gave it to them. And so you see this fully, Jesus fully giving and pouring Himself into his disciples. And He's sharing Himself with His disciples. He's sharing life with them. And then He gives Himself, what we celebrated last week with Good Friday, is that Jesus gave Himself for them as well. He drew people near to Himself. Now, as I'm thinking about this, I think of the one who's actually writing this, the Apostle John. Now, we tend to think of the Apostle John as this sort of wizened, sage person. But Simon is a son of Zebedee, and at one point in time, he and his brother are with Jesus, and they're going through the area of the Samaritans, and the Samaritans don't receive Him. And so he and James come to Jesus and say, "Hey, Lord, want us to call fire down on them from heaven to kill them?" And I'm sure that Jesus says to the Father something like this, and we're giving these guys the keys? Really? And so He called them the sons of thunder as a result of that, Boanerges. At another point in time, his mom or him, depending on which one you want to talk about, they want to figure out who can sit on the right and the left of Jesus in His kingdom. That gets a bit of a correction. Jesus says, this is not how it works. Not how it works. But this same guy is the youngest of the disciples. And he is the only one that the Gospels say is the one who actually has his head on Jesus' heart. And by the time he writes the Gospel of John, history tells us that he's something like 90 years old. And so as he's writing this, how does he refer to himself in the first person? He refers to himself as the disciple that Jesus loved. It changed him. This relationship that he had with Jesus changed him. It changed the central fabric of who he is. And when you experience that trust with God, that no walls up, and that kind of sharing and that generosity that God gives with us, and we share that with others, it melts you, it changes you. It's intended to. You're not the same person after you encounter this. You're different. And this is what we are invited into, trust and sharing. Thirdly, though, that what we see, and when we use that terminology of glory, we're using the terminology of holding nothing back. And I think that frequently we are always trying to hedge our bets. We're always trying to say, well, Lord, I'll do this if you do this. Or I'll give you everything, but don't send me into the mission field. Well, I'll give generously to this person, but you got to bless me. You know, and we do all of these different kind of conditional things with God, but the Lord gives and gives and gives and gives some more. He does not hold back from you. He gave his one and only son. And so the Apostle Paul in Romans 8 talks about this idea of if God did not spare his only son, how much more will he not give us all things with him? That this is the God that we know. That this is a God who holds nothing back from us, and he's calling us to not hold things back from him. And so my question coming from this would be, what are you holding back? Jesus put it this way. He said this to his father. All I have is yours, and all you have is mine. All I have is yours, and all you have is mine. And then Jesus, best that I can tell, is praying us into that relationship. I cannot tell you what a big deal that is. I think we have thirsted too little. We have aimed too low. We have dreamed too small. That this is our God we're talking about. And if God holds nothing back and he's calling us to hold nothing back from him, then we're talking about a wide open space of real life. Not a tiny little quarantined little hut. So what does all that produce? It produces a love connection. Jesus says, Father, you are in me and I am in you. And all of this is so that they will experience your love, the love that you've loved me with, that they would experience that love. Think about this for a minute. How much did the Father love his own son? Was that a lot? Think for a moment. You have in all of the Gospels, we have a little bits of pieces of recording of Jesus' baptism. And we sort of see it as a sort of stamp of validation that this is somehow the Father's validation in terms of who Jesus is. But there's something more going on there. Only one of the Gospels says, this is my beloved Son. The other two of Matthew, Mark, and Luke say, you are my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. What does that look like in Hebrew? You are my boy, and I am delighted in you. This is what this is being said. There's this delight coming down from above, and then the Holy Spirit's presence coming on Jesus, and it's all of this affirmation. This is who you are to me. And Jesus is taking that relationship, grabbing you by the hand, and bringing you into it. This is what's being prayed. And I don't know, last time I checked, if God is doing the praying, it's answered, right? Right? And so we can count on this. This is, folks, this is money in the bank. This is the kind of connection that you and I are given, that Jesus says, I and the Father are one, and now, because of what he did, you are with him. I'm still trying to work out all the implications of this, so I'd like to be able to say I got all this figured out, but I am a neophyte in this. But I am not giving up. I am in a brand new territory. You see, here's how this works. When the connection is strong, the problems work themselves out. In a marital relationship, when the connection is strong, it's not that there's a lack of conflict or a lack of friction. It's that the connection is the venue, and it is the atmosphere and the environment that everything else is worked off on. It's where all the problems are worked out. But it's when you don't have the connection and you're trying to work out the problems, that's where you run into trouble, because you're trying to just work on problems that are not intrinsically hooked into connection. The life is in the connection. Now, so let me see if I can kind of move us toward the finish line here. That Jesus is praying a vision. And his vision is a people connected. It's a people connected with God. And it's a people connected with each other. But that's Jesus' vision. Jesus' vision has never been about you individually going to heaven. It's been about having a people for himself that are connected with him and are connected with each other. Again, connected with him and connected with each other. Connected with him and connected with each other. Now, we Americans, we're fairly well automatons when it comes to this, but this is Jesus' vision. He's praying for something more substantive than what American culture is going to sustain. It's something that has heaven smell to it. It's that kind of connection. And so he says, Father, that they may be one just as we are one, that we're imaging it for them. Now they get to participate in it. I in them and you in me, in order that they may be completed into one. And so the early church worked it out this way. And I'm not saying that the early church got it all right and all these different things. Luke is just recording for us in Acts what actually happened. And this is how he said it. In Acts 4, he says, all the believers were one in heart and mind. They're one. No one claimed that any of his possessions was their own. They, here's that word, shared everything. They held nothing back, everything that they had. God's grace was so powerfully at work on them all that there were no needy persons among them. For from time to time, and this is just working out in a very practical way, from time to time, those who owned land and houses, they sold them and brought the money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. This is crazy. But it's what happened. And this kind of thing, quite frankly, folks, this kind of thing is happening all over the world. It's happening right now. It's happening on our watch. It's just not happening with us in this way yet. But this is a Polaroid, a shot of what happened. These people are connected to him and they're connected to each other. And as a result of that, heaven touches earth. The kingdom of heaven has come into this world's realm in the here and now through that. All kinds of attempts have been made over the years to manufacture this by human means. There's a desire for us to be united. I think that's still in the design. I think all of us have that we desire to be united even when we're all fiercely individualized. But the problem is that when human beings try to create this by themselves, what they get is they get unity at the expense of every other person in the crowd becoming less and not more by achieving the unity. So thus we had communes in the 70s with Jesus freaks. Hippies. Well, they were Jesus freaks in there too. And then you have all of these dystopian types of stories and novels that are read at this point in time, and you see that there's a desire for all this harmony, but it's always at the expense of the people that are participating in it. But not so with God. No, that thing that Jesus is creating is the place where when you come and you give up something of who you are to become part of something bigger than yourselves, you become more of who you are, not less, by doing so. And this is something that the enemy continues to trick us out of, is that we continue to get tricked out of this idea that somehow if I allow myself to experience oneness, that somehow I'm going to become less of a person. I want to tell you that in my marriage with Becky, we've been working on this for 2 years now. And I never thought that we could be as connected as we are. And we're just experimenting. We're just going in and saying, how one can we actually be? What does this look like? Let's just kind of press in. Let's experiment with that. Let's read. Let's put ourselves in the school of oneness that Jesus is providing for us. It's just extraordinary. And I continue to run into these misgivings within myself that are almost unconscious, but it's like I want to experience that oneness, but it scares me to death. And I let down my guard and I think I'm giving up something of myself, and I find that there's a real guy on the other side of this that's a better guy and a more full guy than was on the front side. This is what Jesus is offering. We as Americans, we are fiercely independent and individualistic. Would you agree with that? Fiercely. And so We do not want anybody telling us what to do. We don't want anybody handing down traditions to us. Oh, God forbid that. And what has happened is in our culture, we have decided that we are going to define ourselves apart from relationships with others and define ourselves apart from relationship with God. And it's a bankrupt proposition from the very get-go. That you have been made to define yourself in relation to God and in relation to others. And if you try to do it without that, you're going to continue to beat your head up against the wall. But if you do that with God and with others, it can be an amazing kind of a proposition that God is offering. So what am I saying? Well, lastly here, our oneness with God and with each other, it's a powerful thing. It has the power to actually reveal Jesus to people. That's what Jesus is saying over and over in this, is that you guys portray this in a sin-sick world and people will get to know me as a result of that. And so he says this in John 13:35, by this, by what, everyone will know that you are my disciples by the way that you love one another. If you have love for one another, that's how people will know that you belong to me. You experience this love, you express this love, and you participate in this oneness, and out of that, the world sees me. Out of that, the world sees me, Jesus says. And that is part of the purpose. And it starts with you and I opening up our hearts to him, starting to trust and in trust, starting to share and starting to give. Martin Luther, I said this on Easter, and I think this terminology is really powerful. Martin Luther, the reformer in the 1500s, he said it this way. He described sin as the soul curved back on itself. And then he described faith as the soul curved out toward God and toward others. And I think he nailed it. That faith is a relational dynamic. It's not a proposition. It's a relationship. So Jesus isn't praying that people would just believe a message. He's praying that people would believe him. And that by doing that, they would experience eternal life, or the eternal life, which is knowing him and his Father. So I want to conclude with just two questions. No, three, sorry. Will you slow down enough and open up your heart to trust him? Will you slow down enough and open up your heart to trust him? Will you do that? Now, this message is falling on different ears and different hearts in all kinds of different ways, but every single one of us has hurdles that we are going through. Do I really trust you, Lord, or not? Secondly, will you loose the white-knuckle grip on your stuff and on the things that you're holding on and start sharing it with others? When you do, you will become more free as a person. And then lastly, and I asked this already in some way, shape, or form, what are you holding back from God that he might be calling you to open up on right now? What is it? All of these things are invitations into an interconnectedness with God and with others, that the only way to adequately describe how interconnected it is to use the word one. Would you stand up, please? Let's pray.